Hello and welcome to Two Fat Expats, where we're all about packing as much into your expat life as you can. And that's what we mean when we say fat. We mean full and overflowing. This expat podcast is listened to in over 160 countries, and we have a Facebook group with over 13,000 members. I'm Kirsty Rice. I'm an Aussie based here in Qatar. And each week I'm joined by Nikki Moffat, who's also an Aussie, and she's in Hamburg, Germany. Together we have 12 locations between us, which is a lot of online bank account logins and different ways to order a takeaway dinner on a Friday night. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm good. Good, Kirsty Rice. How are you? It's been a while. What have you been up to?
It has. Well, I've been a bit sick, and we were going to do this last week and I completely lost my voice because I had a killer flu, which I'm happy to report has now struck down my husband, and he, of course, is bedridden.
The man flu. It's a terrible thing.
It is. It is. Okay. So, Nikki, usually about this time we have a bit of a chit-chat and then we introduce, you know, our segments and what we were going to do. But I've heard through the grapevine that there are people that are over hearing us going through our segments. They don't need us to tell us what the segments are anymore. They're done. Am I right?
That's what I heard, Kirsty. I can only say we can only operate on feedback we're given. And so that's what we're operating on.
Okay. So you know what the options are, but what we've also done this week is we've gone out and we've asked in our Two Fat Expats Facebook group, what are your favorite segments and what would you like to hear a little bit more of? And we've kind of had a bit of feedback that expat relationships is popular, as is expat money and expat careers. So we're still going to let you know what we're reading, watching and listening to, but we'll probably cut it down to those sort of three or four areas, which I think, Nikki, kind of covers it all anyway, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Well, yeah. We can make it work. We can make anything work.
I think geographically challenged and expat relationships are kind of the same, but you've got one for this week.
I do.
Tell me about it.
Okay, so this week I was at a meeting at school, and it's a regular principal coffee meeting where the principal meets with the parents from each grade once a quarter and just, you know, offers us the opportunity to give feedback or ask questions, etc. Mm-hmm. And it really made me think. There was a new parent in the meeting and they were asking a lot of questions, and it just made me realize that when you start at a new school in a new country in a new environment, you are geographically challenged because, you know, it depends on where you've moved. It depends on the type of school. It depends on the type of school experience. It depends if you've been an expat before. It depends what all your cultural background and your school experience are. And I know we've talked about schools a lot, but it really sort of, this parent was really struggling with the fact that they don't feel that the academic rigor of the school is equal to the school that they've left. And they were questioning that, and they were asking how that could be changed and achieved. And what the principal was trying to reply and explain was, it's a different kind of learning. Like the IB program and an IB school is a different kind of school. It doesn't mean it doesn't mm-hmm. have academic rigor, and it just means it's a different way to learn and they focus on different things. And mm-hmm. it just really depends on when you come from. So, for example, also when you move, we always talk about, you know, visit a school, see how you feel, how does it feel for your children, what type of education program is. But sometimes when you move to a country or a city like where we live in Hamburg, there's not a lot of options. So if you decide to come here, you kind of have to go with the school. So you walk in and you think, hang on, you know, where I was before, my child was getting a much higher level of maths, or it was much more, I lived in an English speaking country and we had a streamed English program. And so the level of English was much, much higher. You know, the Shakespeare plays they were studying, et cetera, were to a much higher level. And so I just think that it's really hard for someone who walks in and just thinks, wow, this is not what I'm used to. This is not what my children are used to. It's just, it's very overwhelming. I don't know. Have you I know you've been in Qatar a long time, but did you feel that when you moved there from the different systems that you'd been in before into an international school environment?
I was just thinking about that while you were talking, because I was thinking, well, what is the difference? Because basically what we're saying is, if you know, what makes this a uniquely expat problem is that you can move from school to school within your country and you kind of know what you're dealing with and you know what the education standard is and you know what's going to be taught sort of year from year. But once you're in the expat world and you're moving countries, you could be looking at the difference between going to a British and American school as opposed to going to a French school, et cetera. And, yes, I have to say that what I really notice about having children start school in my home country, because those who've listened for a long time know I've got children in different countries going to school. But I've had a couple of kids return home to Australia to go to school. And I find this enormous warmth when I attend those parent information nights. And it's because in more ways than one, they're speaking my language. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you feel more comfortable.
Yeah, I'm more comfortable. I know what the terms are. You know, it's that thing about when you go to an American school and they talk about kids in elementary school and you go, we don't have elementary school, we have primary school. Do you know, like it's silly things, even, you know, which is, you know, I still struggle with middle school in the American system and I feel it makes kids grow up too fast. But it's just what I'm used to. It's not right or wrong. It's just what I've become accustomed to. But I also think that perhaps as expat parents, we worry so much about this stuff, like with the whole, it's always that same thing. It gets back to the academic rigor. And I particularly hear it with my British friends, where they'll say, if they'll be at a British school here, and they'll say, there's no way that, you know, Jenny's going to get back into the, you know, school that from our home, you know, district or whatever, you know, because she's so behind in her math, or she's so behind in this or whatever, you know, there's no way she'll get into the grammar school at whatever. And there seems to be this constant worry. And I've had it myself, right, where I've worried all through my eldest child's schooling of how will this equate to when you get back to Australia. And it's interesting because I remember, you know, I used to buy books at the post office at home that said, you know, you should learn this in grade one. And then I'd kind of try and compare it a bit to where my kids are up to. And you should be doing this in grade two. You know, those books you can get where it kind of shows you the year. And now it's hysterical because my attitude to my last child that's just gone back to Australia was, okay, let's bump him up a grade because that kind of suits his age more and I reckon he'll be all right. And I guess my feeling with that is I think I'm more worried socially. You know, he's a big, tall boy and he would have been, you know, a whole sort of 18 months behind, if that makes sense. And my whole thing was, we will get him a tutor. We will get on top of it straight away. If there's a problem, we will be able to sort this out. Do you know, because you can sort it out when you're there. But I think, is it that parent guilt that has you at that meeting freaking out?
I think it's the parent guilt, and I think it's the feeling of responsibility. You've brought your child here, but it's also the fact that you've never dealt in any other school systems. So what you want is what you know. And I actually had a friend who texted me and said, is this what I sounded like 2 years ago? Because she first arrived from the US, very good quality private schools, and felt that the school here was not giving her children nearly the same level of academic rigor in their education. And I said to her, we had a chat afterwards, and I said to her, look, what do you think now you've been here? She's got a child in grade 11, so in their first year of the DP, the diploma program, and one in grade 10 about to go into that. And I said, do you think that your kids have a better or worse chance now of getting back into college in the States than they would have if you stayed in the States in your, you know, very good high schools? She said, I think they've got a better chance because I think they're learning in a better way. But she said, you couldn't have told me that 2 years ago. I would not have heard it. I wouldn't have listened and I couldn't have heard it. And I think that that's really important for maybe someone who's listening to this now to know that if you're frustrated or if you're worried about a move, look, don't not worry. Of course worry, and of course have your child's best interest at heart, but just know that just like when you move country and you accept that when you first get there, some things are really, really weird, like 10 different rubbish bins for me and my garbage. But now I just accept it. And if I went to a country with just one, I'd think, this is weird. Why am I putting all the stuff in the same bin? You know, it's just one of those things. And children are not like garbage bins, but it's just one of those things. And of course, the IB program was created for children that live this kind of lifestyle. So everywhere they move, they can go in a similar program if that school is available. Mm. And they, so they don't have to go between these different schools that have this very high level of maths or this very advanced something else or whatever, these gift programs for gifted children. These all are meant to sort of all be in place in this one program. I just thought it was very interesting. It just made me really reflect. And perhaps it will help someone else who's watching someone go through that frustration and just understanding them instead of being a little bit, you know, put out by thinking, why is this person, parent, coming here and sort of criticizing our school?
Yes.
Because that's not what they're doing.
Yes.
It sounds like that's what they're doing, but what they're doing is they're advocating for their child and they're going through their own cultural adaptation process.
Yeah, and they're pleading for you to tell them that everything's going to be all right. And, of course, no one can ever tell you that.
Okay, so if you've got a story you'd like to tell us, feel free to go to our website, twofatexpats.com, and click on the microphone and tell us your story about cultural adaptation or school-related stuff, because we'd love to hear it.
So, Nikki, we were talking about money. And I've got a money interview that I want to share with you very soon. But in the meantime, you and I have been talking about Revolut and TransferWise and making transfers with money. And the other day we were chatting and you were telling me about a conversation you'd had with someone.
Yeah, so the other day I was at lunch with it. Three people. I just crashed to lunch. I didn't realize I was just hanging out with these people. They said, we're going to lunch. Do you want to come? I said, okay, we'll do. And we were, after we ordered our food in German, which we're all very proud of, we were chatting about transferring money. And we're talking about, you know, how some people transfer money monthly. So one person in the group was the person who is paid in the US in US dollars, but transfers obviously every month to live in Europe in transfers into euros. So what they had done was to sign a contract with an organization which is based on the website xe.com, www.xe.com. And so they've signed a six-month contract where they've locked in an exchange rate. So because they're paid in one currency and living in another currency, they're of course, when currency changes happen, you know, it can happen either in their favor or against. So in order to reduce the risk, they've decided that every 6 months they'll sign a contract to get a guaranteed transfer rate. So I thought that was an interesting thing.
Yeah. So when you're saying with XE, because I think a lot of us, when we go to look up what the transfer rate is, or, you know, how it's currently tracking, we'll go to XE.com. But I didn't realize you could transfer money with XE. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. I think it's just like TransferWise and other things like that. They also have their own transfer service. Yeah, me either.
I had no idea.
And so another person in the group said, oh, we transfer money monthly as well. That might be of interest to us. And I said, well, you should also look at websites that we've talked about, obviously in the Facebook group, like monito.com, that compares all the transfer rates. So it depends on the amount of money you're transferring. Different entities give you different rates. And of course, what we've always said is if you don't feel safe transferring outside your bank, check the rates and then call your bank and ask them to give you the same rate as TransferWise or Revolut. And that often they will do that. But then I said, or you can just do this app. And I got out my TransferWise app on my phone. I said, look, here, I can just transfer money right here when I'm sitting here at lunchtime, and just showed her the app. So like that was just a group of four people sitting together and three of us transfer money regularly. So it was just one of those conversations that sprung up out of nowhere. And we all walked away with new information, which I thought was Yes. Kind of handy.
Very handy. Okay, now talking about expat money, one of the things that our readers and listeners were very keen to know, our Australian readers and listeners, I must say, are about some new laws that are about to be passed regarding capital gains tax in Australia. And so I should say, if you are not Australian, probably the next 10 minutes is not going to interest you that much, because we're about to talk about a new law with property and what will happen with buying and selling property in Australia if you are a non-resident for tax purposes. But if you're a person with an Australian friend, you will want to listen to this, because you'll want to tell your Australian friends what's going on, because it's big and it's going to change. So I was very, very lucky that I got to speak to Duncan McClellan from Tilbrook Rashid. Now, I want to say, big disclaimer in this is not personal advice. This is just me talking to my accountant, who's giving me very general advice. So please don't take this as your own professional personal advice. You should always go and talk to your own accountant. But I thought that I would share what I'd learnt from Duncan in talking to him for what this means for expats. And I had talked about how there's different types of expats and different types of Australian expats, those who either currently own a house, or those who are about to purchase a property, or those who are wondering what happens if they purchase a property while they're away. Anyway, I asked Duncan all about that and had a quick little chat.
Do you know about what the new rules are? And should people be fearful and panicking and quickly selling, you know, before the next election? Or how do you see it?
Right, so there's a couple of facets to this, and certainly I'm not 100% across it yet. It is still draft legislation, so it hasn't been passed at this point in time, and it's, I think it's unlikely to get through in the next little while, but they could try and rush it through prior to the end of the year or prior to calling an election. That will sort of remain to be seen. There are some pretty... there are some pretty full-on changes that they're suggesting. So one of the main ones affects the first people that you spoke about, the ones that have bought a property or have a property and then head off overseas and become a non-resident for a period of time. Mm-hmm. And broadly, most of the regulatory changes are around that the main residence exemption. So effectively, if you own a house that you live in and then move out of it and sell it, then you don't pay any capital gains tax, because effectively it's your main residence. Now, what they're suggesting to do is say that at the point you become a non-resident, you lose the ability to have that exemption. So the worst possible case might be someone that bought a property, say, in the early 1990s for, say, $100,000 that's now worth a couple of million.
Yep.
They all of a sudden don't get... If they're an Australian resident and they sell it, they pay no tax at all. Whereas if they're a non-resident for tax purposes, what it used to be was that you would still get either the full main residence exemption or a portion thereof. Whereas what they're suggesting now is that as soon as you become a non-resident and sell it, you get none of that. So you're paying capital gains tax, in that example, on $1.9 million worth of growth. So it is cause for thought. I wouldn't be rushing to sell, and certainly I'd be having a chat to the whomever's advisor they have to work out what the possible implications there are. I mean, that was a pretty simple case. But there are lots of other examples in terms of the current rules basically say once you move out of your primary residence, if you don't have another one, then you can treat the primary residence as your main residence for the next 6 years. Now, they're suggesting that that goes away as well if you move overseas. But if you move back within that six-year period, the expectation is that you're going to be okay if you then sell it. So there's a few kinks, I suppose, to be worked out there. And so certainly it's not a one-size-fits-all approach to it. It's going to be a case-by-case. But certainly for those that are looking at leaving, and this is all expected to go through on the... It's slated at the moment to be effective from the 1st of July 2019.
Right. So, Duncan, is it if you it's only if you're going to sell it while you're away? Like if you return back and you move back into that house and that house becomes your primary place of residence again, if you then were a resident in Australia for the next 5 years or so and you went to sell it, you're not going to cop a capital gains tax then, are you?
Potentially, but again, I'm not 100% across it at this stage, again, because it's not legislation yet.
Right. But
effectively, there's two schools of thought. One is that if you're within that six-year window and you come back, then you can pick up your house and carry on.
Right.
The other one is that there might be some form of apportionment. So effectively, in the time up to when you were a non-resident, that might be... And the time that you come back after being a non-resident, that might be the bit where you're entitled to the exemption, whereas the bit you're away might not be. So again, it will be case by case, and there is a bit to play out in the way that legislation is going to be drafted, because generally legislation this big or that has this many financial ramifications normally has some form of grandfathering to it, mm-hmm. whereby people that have done things in the past aren't as affected. They haven't really mentioned anything in this regard about it now, so I'm a bit surprised by that, and whether or not they put their minds to that moving forward, and perhaps that case I spoke about for someone that's owned a house for a long time might get a bit more preferential treatment. But again, that remains to be seen.
Okay, and I think I'm going to ask you a curly question now. So what happens if you're someone like in my situation where I'm a resident for tax purposes because I'm back and forth, but I'm married to someone and own a house with someone who is a non-resident for tax purposes?
Yep, that is certainly a curly one. again, so you guys, are in the eyes of the ATO, you're viewed as separate people. So you own half of the house and Greg owns half of the house.
Yep.
In your specific case, we would be arguing that it's your main residence and therefore you would qualify for the exemption. Greg may struggle or wouldn't qualify for the exemption because, and again, the reason they're doing this is they're saying, well, how can it be your main residence if you don't even live in Australia?
Yes.
And so that's their argument. And so we'd possibly be able to qualify for half the property and the other half we would pay some CGT on. So we'd need to look at what the land cost you, what the build cost you, and then what the property sold for to work out what the gain was, and probably we'd disregard your gain and Greg would have some top-up tax to pay.
Right, okay. So in a nutshell, if someone had only just become an expat now and they were planning on being back in Australia within 6 years, they probably won't have an issue. But if you are someone who's going to be away for longer, you will, if legislation goes through.
Potentially, and again, it really does depend on when, if they're looking to sell the house. So if they're looking to sell the house while they're away, or they're in the process of, I mean, the classic case is someone that's looking to head away now, probably, and is tossing up whether or not to sell their place or whether to rent it out. I'd be encouraging them to have a look at their long-term plans and try and work out what the expectation is in terms of whether they're going to be back in a shorter time period or whether it's going to be a longer time period. If it is going to be a longer time period, especially, and that they think they're going to sell their house in the future, then possibly bringing forward that sale date. Certainly, the sale date is the key there, to prior to 1 July to ensure that they're availed the main residence exemption might be a good look. Now, again, that really depends on when they bought their property, how much they bought it for, and what the potential gain is. So someone that bought a house last year for $1 million that's going to sell it for $1 million or thereabouts aren't going to be affected at all, because basically there's no capital gain and therefore there's no tax to pay. So it really does depend on what that differential is between what you're going to sell it for, what you expect to sell it for, and what you paid for it at the same time.
Right. And so this legislation hasn't gone through as yet, has it, no, Duncan? And
it, so has, it has not.
I guess it's just waiting to see if it is going to go through, and then there'll be a period of time that you'll have to make a decision anyway. So would you suggest that rushing in and doing something right now really doesn't make any sense?
I think jumping at shadows is something you don't want to do, but equally the property selling process does take time.
Right. And
so I think if people are genuinely worried about it, I'd be going through the steps of working out, what did I pay for my house? How long have I lived there? What am I expecting to sell it for? And therefore, do I have a potential gain that I'm making? And if I do have a gain and my expectation is that I want to sell my house, whilst I'm away, then perhaps that's the case you'd bring forward. But having those ducks in a row in terms of understanding your own position is probably the key at the moment. And then once this legislation becomes clear, and again, Parliament started sitting only a couple of days ago now, and I expect that it's either going to get pushed through relatively quickly, which will give us 4 months or thereabouts, or it won't go through at all until perhaps after the election. So it's going to be one of those ones where we're going to need to watch this space, and yep. We'll know probably in the next month or so which way it's going to go. But again, it will have a significant impact on a number of property owning expats, that's for sure.
First of all, Duncan sounds very lovely, Kirsty. But what I was going to say is a lot of this stuff we've been hearing online is it's imminent. And, you know, people have sold their houses or are preparing them immediately for sale. And this seems, after hearing Duncan talk very sensibly, that it's maybe not as imminent as we thought.
And that's the thing, isn't it? When you get that voice of reason, like the person that doesn't have a vested interest in the game, who says, hang on, you know, and the person, I guess, who sees a lot of accounting situations, you know, Duncan has definitely handled all of mine and G stuff, and I think that we're very complicated in that I am a dual resident for tax purposes and he is a non-resident for tax purposes and all that sort of guff. But, yes, I thought that I travelled to Kuwait a couple of weeks ago and met up with some Australians, and one of the first things they said to us was, oh, we've just sold our house. And they said in kind of this panic tone, you know, we've just sold our house because, you know, that new law is going to come in, and we've had the house for 20 years and that was the last thing we needed, was to be stuck with a capital gains tax bill. And I was like, wow, because I guess they were thinking you've got to do it now before, you know, the end of the tax year. So it is interesting. I agree that it was that whole thing of, well, let's just wait first, see whether it does get passed, and then actually see exactly what it is that they say they're going to do, and then look at what we're going to do about it.
Yes, but then there's always the calm reasoning voice of the accountant, but then there's also the whole if it passes and they're going to do that, and then everyone's trying to dump their house on the market at the same time, then there's good media is going to blow up about that as well. So I guess it's, you know, you have to make what decision is right for you at the time.
If you look at roughly at the Bureau of Statistics, it'll say there's, you know, largest possible amount, 500,000 expats. But I guess if you looked at travelling, there's 1 million expats out of the country at the time, but they're travelling and working abroad. They're probably not fully fledged, I'm away for a long time kind of expats. Now, I guess you've got to look at how many people have houses and whether it would send off, like how many people have bought houses recently and they're not really, there isn't that much of a capital gain. I mean, to put it into perspective, we bought a beach house 10 years ago and sold it probably 3 years ago, and really there wasn't that much capital gain because it was in an area that, you know, it didn't really grow. It wasn't that sort of property. We didn't really make a lot of money out of it. So it wasn't an issue for us. I guess the people that it's a big issue for are the people who've been expats for a long period of time and they've made a mozza, isn't it, on their housing.
Or, yeah, and have houses in big markets like capital cities. So, yeah, I guess so.
They've still got to make that capital gain, don't they, for it to be a problem for them.
Yes, but if they have to pay the capital gain from the beginning and they've, you know, selling the house they lived in with their parents, I can see that that would be quite substantial depending where they are. So, yeah, you're right. And so it's all about what suits you at the time. But perhaps the people who've already sold their house in Kuwait, maybe that was a bit hasty. Did you tell them?
No, because I totally saw their point, because he has been away for a very long time, do you know, and he's had the house for 20 years. And I thought, you know, maybe I'd do the same, because the other interesting thing at play right now is there is a lot of talk that the housing market in Australia isn't looking that healthy right now. So, you know, housing prices could drop next year as it is. So imagine if you were weighing up all those things, if you were someone who is thinking, maybe we should sell, you might be pushed along a bit to go, oh, I'm not quite sure what's going to happen with this new law. You know, maybe that's just enough to make me sell. But if you're someone like maybe me, who's just built a house that I have no intention of selling anytime soon, it doesn't really apply to me, right? So I'm not in that mindset because I'm thinking, well, I'm not about to sell this house. And there is a possibility, like Duncan said, that there could be a 6-year kind of window in there as well. So I just sort of think I'm more of the, well, let's just wait and see how this sort of pans out because it hasn't been passed yet. So yes, but I did think that Duncan did make it clearer of where we're sitting at now and what the situation is.
Yeah, so thanks, Duncan. That was awesome.
Okay, Nikki, location, location, location.
Yeah, jumping right in. So, Kirsty, this week we're at the letter U, and U is for Uzbekistan. So I spoke this week to Wendy. Wendy is a single parent. She has a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old, and she's a science teacher at an international school. So we talked a lot about science because I've got a science problem in my house right now. But before she moved to Tashkent in Uzbekistan, she was a teacher for 15 years in Cairo. So she's had quite an amazing ride. And Cairo has a huge expat community. And so moving to Uzbekistan was quite a big change for her. So I started off, of course, with this on a scale of 1 to 10, what's your current level of in love with Uzbekistan?
Ooh, scale of 1 to 10. I would probably say a 7. 7. I'm not in love with it, but I really enjoy it.
And has that been trending up since you arrived?
Yeah, it's somewhere that definitely grows on you. It's got, you know, we've got the, you know, the communist bloc apartments, which are not the most beautiful thing. And then suddenly you'll turn the corner and there'll be the most amazing piece of architecture and history and obviously the Silk Road sort of historical stuff. And suddenly you get blown away all over again, which is just gorgeous and lovely.
What have you found is your best local find?
Ooh, that's actually quite a tough one because that's probably the thing that's quite hard here. Language is always quite an issue. So sometimes it's just a nice little cafe where, you know, you get just something will click with service where maybe you just, I'm trying to think, there's a nice little cafe sort of around the corner that it just turns out that the owner speaks the most amazing fluent English. And it's really handy for our house. And although I'm not that kind of person, sometimes you just have those days where you just don't want to have your brain in gear. And it's just lovely to be able to speak to somebody and for somebody to explain everything to you, because actually language here can be quite an issue. I probably would go as far as saying that this is probably the country that I've been in where people are least likely to be able to speak English. And obviously that's maybe being very, very selfish, but it's just a big difference and it's an interesting one to get used to. So finding something like that is a big deal.
Does your job support you learning that, or do you have special lessons, or are you just left to go?
Well, yeah, my school sort of do sort of help out, and we've got obviously lots of local members of staff as well, so that's nice and it helps. And obviously you do, because you're just immersed in it, you have to pick up the usual, you know, taxi talk and polite things and so on. One of the things here that's really interesting is that some people speak Uzbek and some people speak Russian. So that makes it sort of twice as challenging. So, you know, you can be in an Uzbek taxi driver's car, and if you say, you know, spasiba as opposed to rahmat, you'll really offend them because you've just thanked them in Russian rather than Uzbek. But obviously you're never sure which one they speak. So that's okay. The language thing is fun.
I'm sure. So you've lived in Cairo, you've lived there and possibly some other places. What's one place you'd love to live?
Oh, I'd love to live. In a strange way, I would love to live back home in Scotland, but also I'm not there, so I obviously don't really maybe want to live there as much as I think. It's the grass is always greener. That's that syndrome that gets there. Or possibly the other extreme, I would love to live in Sydney.
Who wouldn't? It's a great place.
Yeah, you know, I fell in love with Sydney years ago, and yeah.
What drives you crazy about where you are?
What drives me crazy? That's an interesting one. Probably the fact it's, again, Tashkent is a little bit of a strange city in that it doesn't feel like a city. So everything is really spread out. It's a very small place, so it only takes really about half an hour to go from end to end, in it. But you can't just go one place and do all your shopping, for example. Everything's sort of spread out. So you find yourself having to, jump in a taxi here, get in a bus here, jump around, and you're moving around. And, as a working single mom, that gets really annoying sometimes. So that gets quite frustrating that it's all very sprawled out.
I'm sure. What's the best piece of advice you've ever been given about living an expat life?
Oh, best piece of advice. Gosh, you get advice all the time, doesn't it? I think it sounds really...
Everyone's got it.
Maybe it's really corny and cheesy, but just to relax and go with it and enjoy it. I think it can get really stressful. I think everyone probably feels the same, that one morning you wake up and the same things that you loved yesterday will drive you absolutely crazy the next. And I think just to relax and enjoy and appreciate it is probably the best piece of advice. It's the most simple, but I think it is the one that has to work, because sometimes it does drive you crazy. As much as we have quite an amazing lifestyle in many ways, there are mornings that I wake up and think, oh, I just want an easier day today, for example, or something.
What about the biggest lesson that you've learnt, which is kind of related in a way?
Ooh, biggest lesson I've learnt. Probably just not to prejudge people. I know we shouldn't, and it's something you learn probably through life anyway. But there are people who I've met on my first day of meeting them, and I think, and I obviously come to lots of judgments about them and judging a book by its cover, and obviously in the international sort of expat sort of scenes and circles, you meet all sorts of people. And I have been proven wrong so many times. People that have maybe annoyed me, for example, in the first meeting, within a couple of months were really, really good friends, and vice versa as well. Just to not judge a book by its cover, and that, I think we're really privileged to meet so many different types of people from all over the world, and just to get on and, judge them on face value and see what happens, really.
I love it when it's growing on you, Nikki. That means you've got a place, you've got somewhere, the path is going somewhere if it is growing on you. Hey, Nikki, your Fab Five and the location was one in the top three of things that people liked about the podcast and said they wanted to have more. And I think it's that whole thing, because I think one of our biggest episodes was where was your favorite place to live, wasn't it?
Yes,
it was. Like, people always like to know your favorite place to live, your favorite place to holiday, whatever. So I think we will definitely return, A to Z, and maybe we'll adjust some of those Fat Five questions to sort of talk more about exactly what it's like to live in a location. And if I'm off on that, please, people, send us a message and tell us, or hop on the Facebook page and tell us what you think. But I think it's great sort of hearing too from someone who's lived in Cairo and then gone to Uzbekistan and then can sort of tell you the difference.
I know, and that's the thing. So someone said, I find the five questions a little bit restrictive, and I said, oh, so do I, because I usually talk to people for about an hour. I said, I love hearing everything about where they live and what they do, and I really enjoy it. And I agree, but we have to edit to something, so that's what we edit to at the moment. But yes, absolutely, I think I love going to a different location every week. I think we need to keep that in.
So, Nikki, I've been reading, and there's a couple of articles that I wanted to talk about this week, not so much a book, but I did see a fantastic article on The Insider about Disney princess jobs. Did you see that one?
I did, but I had a quick look when you put it in the show notes. Yes.
It's very cute, isn't it? So it sort of runs through all the Disney princesses and what they would be doing for a crust. I was trying to think of a few off the top of my head, but we had Ariel was record producer from memory, and Moana was in the Navy. She was an officer in the Navy. And I think the best thing was they had pictures of these princesses in their working attire. So Jasmine was a UN ambassador and she was there all suited up. Aurora worked for a coffee company. She was the CEO. Thought that was pretty good.
Snow White, the psychologist.
I think maybe Sleeping Beauty was with the coffee company. No, or it might have been Aurora. Anyway, I will put the link there so people can go and have a look. But I just thought it was a great one to sort of maybe show your kids as well. And then I had a personal one that I really liked from Mindshift, and it was called How Ending Behavior Rewards Helped One School Focus on Student Motivation and Character. And it was all about moving away from that mindset of every child gets a prize and everybody gets a sticker, everybody gets a coloured bracelet, and how a school had kind of completely got rid of that idea and had started looking at sort of a different practice of how to motivate and encourage. And it was really a lot more about teachers taking a child aside and asking them sort of what their motivations were, and you know, praising them and saying, you know, you did a really good job in this, and maybe it's not done in public, and maybe it's just a comment rather than you know, a big event. And I think the phrase one of the teachers said was, it's a comment, not an ordeal. And they were saying that the kids did enjoy that more and that there was more growth from that. And it's something I really truly believe with children, because I think our children don't fall for the whole everyone gets a prize and everyone gets what do you get when you've just participated? You get a participation certificate. Yeah. And I think kids just see straight through that. And I just thought it made for interesting reading. So I'll put that there as well.
Yeah, perfect. Well, that's a little bit more upbeat than what I was reading this week, because I read an article on The Verge about Facebook moderation.
I read that.
And so, because you know, there's so much, you know, people say, oh, this violates, you know, Facebook's things. Why don't you take it down immediately? You know, why isn't this taken down? And I've reported it. You should report it. And people get all carried away. And then you look at what's behind that, and see, these aren't actual Facebook employees. These are people that are contracted by Facebook, because these aren't the people sitting in the beautiful, you know, light, airy, throw a ball and let's have a ping pong battle while we think about something, how to make the app better. These are people who, like, I guess your traditional old school call center types, who are just in the back and they have to do as much as they can in the amount of time that they can, and they're really under a lot of pressure. And it was it was quite a horrifying article. And it opens with this scene where someone gets up, a trainee gets up and has to moderate a post in front of other trainees. And so a monitor displays a video that's been posted, and none of the trainees have seen it before, including her. So it's like her, you know, graduating from training. And then she presses play and the video depicts a man being murdered and someone stabbing him. And, you know, and so she has to tell the room, should the post be removed? Why should it be removed? What's the right classification, etc.? And so, because these people that do this job go through this time after time after time, there are terrible things posted on social media all the time that it's being taken down. And it sort of talks about how they have, you know, they don't really have a lot of trauma training, they don't really have a lot of support, but they're seeing horrific things over and over again. And also talked about how some of them become conspiracy theorists, because they walk in with perfectly normal views about the world, and then they walk out of this job being totally taken over by these things that, you know, they're exposed to day in and day out, for hours and hours at a time. And then they are being moderated by quality assurance people. So the quality assurance people who are paid $1 an hour more than the moderators, then go in and randomly pick things that they've taken down and say whether they've done it correctly or not. Yeah. And apparently there's huge pressure on them. So one of the quality assurance guys started taking a gun to work, because he would go to his car after work and there'd be a group of people standing around him saying, no, I made the right decision. You're saying I made the wrong decision. You know, they're under incredible pressure. So, that, you know, they've got huge mental health issues. Obviously, the lifespan of the job role is very short, and they have a lot of PTSD, you know, undiagnosed and diagnosed.
Well, it's that whole thing. You can't unsee something, you know, and it's in a split second. And these are the poor people that are seeing everything the rest of us don't want to see.
Yeah.
You know, there was a similar, and I know you're going to put the link in there too on NPR about the same sort of thing, people cleaning up the internet. But, you know, yesterday my younger son is quite protected really from social media and those sort of things. And he's not into it either. Do you know, there's a whole different realm of kids now that aren't into sort of different because they've got WhatsApp groups and they've got other things going. I could see him looking in this WhatsApp group, everyone's chatting, da da da, heard him giggle, then heard him say, "Oh my God, I thought that was fake." And he said, "Mum," and he showed me, and one of his friends in the group, and it's a big group, like it's one of those big, you know, let's put the entire year's 7 cohort in the one group sort of thing. One of his friends had attached a gif of you see this pig, a great big pig, and someone's like stroking its back and to sort of keep it calm, and then you see this axe come down and they completely cut off its head.
Oh my God.
And yeah, and blood comes spurting out everywhere. And it did look fake. It did look like it was a fake pig and someone, because the axe just cuts it so cleanly, like the guillotine sort of comes down and it all happens so cleanly. Now, I didn't want to see that. Like when he showed me, I went, "Oh my gosh," like I got so shocked, and I keep seeing it. Like it keeps coming back in my mind because I keep thinking, "Oh, that was the most shocking thing to see." And so my reaction to him was sort of like, "Sweetie, you've got to report that, or you have to tell that person." He said, "Oh, it's gone." It was, and in that second, it was sort of gone because someone called the child a loser, like for putting it on there. "Oh, you loser! You know, take that down or whatever." And now there's all sorts of cultural things at play in this whole conversation. The fact that it was a pig, in this Muslim country, and people's feelings about pigs and etc. That's one tiny, tiny part of it. The fact that it was gore and blood and awful to see and not something to be shared between 12-year-old children or anyone. Do you know that it's not the content that we want to be sharing with everyone? But so I'm sitting going, you know, how much do you have to police of everything your child is doing? Which makes me think, and I'll find an article this week that's sort of about why this woman had written about why she moved away completely from having her children on any form of social media. And it was all about how she'd been on Musical.ly, and Musical.ly is now called something else. But we can talk about it next week because that's yet another article. Maybe both of us have a read of it and talk about it next week. But you cannot unsee what you've seen, and it does have a huge effect on you. And, you know, we've already seen the statistics, and you and I have spoken to this before about mental health in people that work in social media and people who are moderators and being social media moderators or community managers. And yeah, I don't think it's somewhere you want to be for more than a couple of hours a day.
Yeah. I mean, and even if you had to see that for a couple of hours a day, that's quite confronting. And then they're doing awful. That all day, every day. But yes, it's very difficult.
Yeah. You know, it's awful just seeing people be obnoxious to each other for 2 hours a day.
Yeah.
Like just having people be terrible, which is, you know, a lot of what I see of people, you know, just being outraged and obnoxious and angry and whatever. Like that rubs off on you if you do too much of it. And I'm constantly, each week I'm sure I'm reading something else about, you know, 7 tips for removing yourself from your online life, you know, just to make sure that you have that balance. And you do have to have those tricks of getting up and moving and, you know, getting out of things and not getting hooked on certain things, because I do have to moderate in my life, but in a nice civilized middle class way, not in a pigs getting their heads cut off or people getting murdered way. I just cannot imagine what it's like for those people to view that.
But it's not only to view it, but to just be under so much pressure to make a decision on it immediately and just be able to pump through all these things. Like it's just very, It's many layers of pressure and trauma. Anyway, I just thought it was an interesting article. And there's also a documentary that was called The Cleaners, which follows five moderators and their job. So I might have a look at that this week if I can. I'll see.
Yes. Yeah.
Talking about watching, then what are you watching, Kirsty?
Okay. Well, you know, just another lighthearted topic. We're a bit sort of morbid here today. But Leaving Neverland, which I think everyone is talking about at the moment, which is, of course, is the documentary about Michael Jackson, where the two boys who are now men have come out to talk about the abuse that they endured. I watched Leaving Neverland, and I wanted to say, if anyone else is out there, because this is one of the services we provide, is how you get to watch these things. If you're in a location where you go, I don't get HBO, hop onto YouTube, because it's definitely on YouTube. I think the channel that's got it is called Pink or something. But that is how I did it. I went to YouTube, and it was split up over two nights, and so there was two parts to it. So I watched that, and then I also watched the Oprah follow-up, because what Oprah did was, straight after the show had been screened in America, she had the two guys and the filmmaker, and she did it as Oprah only can, with an audience of people who've been abused as children.
Sadistic, I thought. I thought that was quite. That was hard.
No, I thought it was brilliant.
Did you? Okay.
I thought it was brilliant, because the reason I thought it was brilliant, and sorry, I'll get you and tell me why it was hardcore, but I thought if you had had just an everyday audience, I don't think you would have had that same wealth of feeling, but also
all the nodding heads
and the understanding. Because I think the thing about, for me, the thing that I thought was really fantastic about Leaving Neverland was I learnt so much about about grooming.
Yeah.
Do you know? I think I have, you know, I used to, I'm not sure if I've ever told you this before, Nikki, but I worked at a radio station once where one of my colleagues who I really liked, I found out sort of a few years later that he was a pedophile, and he had done all sorts of terrible, terrible things that I did not understand. And, you know, when you find out later that someone you know is a convicted pedophile, you sort of have all these questions of, you know, well, how did I go and have beers with him on a Friday night and not pick it? Or, you know, how does that work with his own kids? Or how does that work with the people that were around him, and what was he doing and whatever? But I thought what I learned from this is how that whole confusion for a child of, this person is seemingly a good person doing good things, who really seems to love me, but they're doing these terrible things to me, do you know, but they love me. But and just that confusion and the how someone grooms a parent as well to get to their child. It was fascinating, the stories with the parents, wasn't it?
It was, and I have to say, in the watching, it was very confronting. And but it was, the documentary maker did an amazing job of it, because I think when I saw them just talk to Oprah, I was thinking, obviously you've seen the documentary, so you've got a background, but the documentary did a much better job of sort of walking you through it, and that's why it was 4 hours, because it needed all those steps to explain, you know, we're not just jumping in on the very deep end. We're talking about how it all started and the bit by bit and the grooming side of things. One of the things there that what I appreciated about watching the follow-up, the Oprah interview, was that what Oprah said is that there are no current stars in the world as big as Michael Jackson was, because people don't have the star power now and the absolute sort of untouchability almost that stars had then. You know, it's very hard to understand how big a deal it was for this family from Australia to be at Neverland for 2 weeks and that kind of stuff. Like I feel that was a really good sort of setting of the scene, because there was the whole thing about the kids and everything, but also just the untouchability. And now with social media and, you know, all this stuff, there's much more accessibility, even with all the rules and you know, obviously when people, stars have staff, you know, you sign non-disclosures or whatever. But I just think that it was just, that was kind of a very telling thing that wasn't necessarily covered in the documentary. It was just sort of like the stratospheric star power of someone like that. It was very much easier for them to control all the narrative around all the things.
Mm. And how did you cope? Because, you know, like you said before, it was really traumatic viewing in that the guys went into detail about what the process was. And you know, you're sitting there conflicted thinking, why do you have to tell me this detail? I'm not coping well with this detail. This detail is really rough to listen to. But then at the same time, you're going, oh, wow, your detail and his detail are so, so similar that unless you really have colluded and got together and said, we're going to say exactly the same thing. But I wondered, was it to show you just how awful it was and how involved it was, but also to sort of corroborate their stories to show that, you know, this is their truth, you know, this is exactly what happened and they're both talking about the same thing? I don't know, because you don't usually hear that detail, you know, when someone's talking about a situation like this.
Then it basically also correlated with what the trials were. So what the children had said in the trials was also what they had said to them. Mm. So what my thoughts are, or my, I just, what made them tell their parents, what was the difference in the relationship between them and their parents or Michael Jackson and those people that they came forward earlier? That's where I really struggled. Like, I understand why the two people now didn't, and I understand what he said, but how was that spell broken with the other two children that they were able to do it when they were still children, which would have been very traumatic?
Yeah. Do you wonder if he didn't have the same time invested in the grooming? Because, you know, like one of those children, so for people that haven't seen it, you know, the children talk about he put in a lot of time before he kind of stepped out of line. Do you know, like there was a lot of come visit me, come see me at the hotel, I'm going to go to your house. You know, there was one boy where he was faxing him, you know, every day, sending fax messages for 2 years or something, wasn't it? Or was it not that long? Was it 6 months maybe? But it was, you know, this constant barrage of, you know, talk to me, leaving messages, writing, you know, the whole thing. And I was thinking at the time, well, how did you fit in? Because, you know, you hear the first story and then you wonder, you actually start wondering, when does the second boy come in? Like, how did that work? And how did it work with the, you know, the next people and the next people? And where does Macaulay Culkin fit in and all of that? And there's no way he could have invested as much time with all of those parents.
Yeah, I know, but I was thinking if you invest so much time, you know what you're doing. Therefore, why would you risk it when it's not, when you're not that invested? I mean, these are all the questions that we'll never know the answer to.
Anyway, Nikki, what are you watching?
Well, it's just on a bit of a lighter note, just quickly. I was watching The Widow on Amazon, my Amazon Prime, which we've talked about before. Should you get, should you not? So it's got Kate Beckinsale and Matthew, well, I can't pronounce his last name, but Patrick from Offspring for all the Australians out there.
Right. yes. That's what happened to him, did it? He went off.
He left so he could go and make it big, and now he has with Kate Beckinsale. It's a mini series. I think it's 6 parts. It's just an easy watch. It's, you know, it's a bit of a spy, a bit of a thriller, and it's got lots of twists and turns, so I can't talk about it. But Kate Beckinsale looks a little bit – she's the main role. I didn't really recognise her when I first started, but no, I enjoyed it. It's a bit lighter than Leaving Neverland.
And is she a widow? Is that what it's about?
Well, she is a widow, but there's some twists and turns. And her husband was Matthew Neverland.
So once again, he plays someone that dies.
More or less. Well, you've got to watch it to find out.
Right. Which was pretty much his whole shtick on Offspring, wasn't it?
And the other thing I was watching was Secret City, which is another Netflix thing, and it's an Australian spy government drama based on some novels by Chris Ullman, I found out, who's a political journalist in Australia. And the Prime Minister in season two is another Offspring protege, was Dr. Chris Havell from Offspring.
Oh, yes.
So I was thinking, oh, here's all my Offspring world coming together now, because I just recently watched Offspring as well. So there you go. In my Australian culture.
Yeah, the Offspring is a great series. So Secret City. Yes, I did see that pop up in my feed. I'll have to have a look at that as well.
What are you listening to?
Okay, so we had a couple of people in the group, in the Two Fat Expats Facebook group, who suggested listening to Abu Dhabi's Temporary People, which was on Conversations with Richard Feidler, except it wasn't Richard Feidler. And that's why I guess it's just called Conversations.
Because sometimes now, it's not.
Yes, I thought it was absolutely brilliant. It's based on the book Temporary People. And obviously living in Qatar, I had a vested interest, but I think any expat, well, Nikki, you'll be able to tell me because you haven't lived in the Middle East. Did you still find those comparisons of being a temporary person and raising your child in a temporary world? Were you still able to make those comparisons?
Absolutely. I mean, anywhere you live, it's temporary unless you become a permanent resident, and we never have. So I understand that it's a different kind of different way of looking at sometimes in the Middle East, and particularly with such long term. I mean, his father worked all his working life in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, I think it was over 40 years.
I mean, that's massive to not then have any residency rights in return. But I mean, and I enjoyed it, and he has a lovely speaking voice. He's very easy to listen to.
Yeah, good.
But would you have asked different questions?
Yeah,
that's what I want to know. I was listening, thinking Kirsty would ask different questions.
What, can you give me an example? What were you?
Well, I don't know. I guess it was obviously presented to an audience who had never lived as expats, needed to understand the whole thing. So they just started it from the very bottom up and walked through it. And I think that's great. But I sort of think they built it up and then they sort of lost maybe what could have been some more interesting stuff. I don't know.
And is that because we're looking at it with complete and total knowledge of what?
Of
what
course.
What an expat looks at it. And the general public basically don't care.
That's right. No, so I totally get it. I understand exactly why she did it that way. But I kept feeling very frustrated. And I just, not very frustrated, but I just thought, you know, if he was being interviewed by, you know, for an expat audience, you know, in a festival about writing, third culture writing or something, then I think the series of questions would have been different. That's all.
Look, I think he just didn't make a big deal about things like, I don't know any Emirati people. I didn't have anything to do with any Emirati people. I only hung out with people that look like me. Do you know, all that stuff where you go, oh, well, a bunch of expats would sit together and pick that apart. Big time, they'd want to be talking about it. But I did love it in the fact that I love that people are listening to him. Do you know that he's telling that story and that he's got this huge following and that people are really listening to him and enjoying him?
But can I understand it that he now lives in Abu Dhabi and his parents are back in Kerala? Is that right?
I didn't get that. I wasn't sure whether he'd gone back to the States or not. I must admit, I didn't catch that at the end, where he'd chosen. His parents definitely have gone back to Kerala, because his parents, once you don't work, you can't stay.
Yeah.
So they don't have visas. They can't do it. No, because I gathered he was saying he was having to now go back and visit his parents in Kerala, just like his parents had to do with their parents.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I didn't understand where he meant he was doing that from the States, or whether from Abu Dhabi. I like the way he said Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, he did say it in a very specific way every time.
It's like when you talk to people from Qatar. Yeah. Yes.
Okay, quickly, non-expat related, the other podcast I've been listening to recently is David Tennant Does a Podcast With. Is the name of the podcast. And he started it a month or 6 weeks ago. And so I listened to his Olivia Colman interview before she won the Oscar.
She's so the toast of the town.
She is the toast of the town. It's very sort of, he's like the English Dax Shepherd who does the armchair expert ones.
Right.
But it's very English. It's quite, you know, self-deprecating. It's not.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and when he interviews Americans, it's quite interesting because it's a different kind of style. He tries to keep his style, but Americans don't have that same sort of, oh, sorry, no, you go, no, you tell me what you were going to say. Like, they don't really have that kind of talking and conversational style. He did Whoopi Goldberg. He did Gordon Brown, and, you know, they're both Scottish. And I thought that was actually quite an interesting one. That's been my favorite one so far. So I'm going to keep listening, and I'll put the link in case anyone else isn't listening and would like to have a listen.
Fantastic. Okay, Nikki, can I just remind everyone that today's podcast, any advice that you heard is not professional. You should always go out and get your own personal advice from a professional. But we do hope you enjoyed it.
Yeah, thanks so much. And if you did enjoy it and you haven't given us a rating, feel free to just dash it in and give us a rating in your favorite podcast app, because we'd love that. That helps other people find our podcast.
Okay, I will talk to you again next week, okay. Nikki Moffat.
You too, Kirsty Rice. Bye-bye.
Bye.